Welcome to Trinity School Pod Misum. Thank you for downloading this episode. This podcast is produced by Trinity School in New York City, a diverse community of learning creating engaged and inspired citizens since 1709. I'm Kevin Ramsey, Director of Communications at Trinity School. This podcast features alumnus author Scott Newman, class of 2017. Scott is a writer, editor, podcast host, and founder. He has visited nearly 40 countries and has lived in Amman, Antibes, New York, Sydney, and Paris. His debut book is The Night Before, The Morning After. Scott spoke with me at Trinity for a wide-ranging discussion about life, narrative nonfiction, and his book. Scott Newman, welcome back to Trinity. It's nice to have you here.
Kevin Ramsey, thanks so much for hosting me in the old stomping ground.
It's my pleasure. The question I know I want to start with today is, can you tell me about the first memoir or autobiography that you remember reading?
I certainly could. I just have to reflect upon what exactly that was. The first memoir that really sticks in my mind was A Movable Feast by Ernest Hemingway, which I read my freshman year of high school. It's interesting because the book is branded as fiction, and that was an intentional choice by Hemingway. I had an annotated copy that I had got at Shakespeare and Company. Maybe actually I read it my sophomore year of high school, not my freshman, because I had moved to Paris after my freshman year of high school alone. And I picked up this copy of A Movable Feast, an annotated copy at Shakespeare and Company, which is one of the greatest bookstores in the world, in my humble, unsolicited opinion. Anyway, so I'm reading this book, and the interesting part, Kevin, is that, among other things, is that he calls it fiction. And in the annotated copy, he says, when you've sat around a dinner table with 10 men, and then, you know, the next day you've listened to 10 guys tell completely different stories about what transpired the night before, you'll understand why I must call this book fiction. So, I mean, there's a whole discussion to be had about genre and autofiction, memoir, biography, about journalistic integrity, of course, factors into the conversation. This is just to say that that book, people read it as a work of nonfiction, and I read it as a work of nonfiction when he's writing about his adventures in Paris with F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda and Gertrude Stein. But in fact, he made the conscious decision to call it fiction. Where the line was, I'm not really sure what he embellished or didn't embellish. I don't think anybody will ever really know. But it was a first-person narrative, largely autobiographical, even if not nonfiction to the letter. I, in my book, chose to be much more close to what happened. I changed names. I changed some identifying characteristics of people. But yeah, that was a time in my life. I'd moved to Paris, as I mentioned, alone, surviving off of baguettes and cigarettes. After freshman year of high school, I got this book. It was just a really formative time in my life, being 16, having just come back from Paris, reading Hemingway, reading Fitzgerald, and thinking, maybe I could do something like that. I wrote my first novella that summer, actually, fiction, but heavily autobiographical, about a young man who leaves New York and goes to Paris for the summer.
Tell me about the annotations. Was it connecting the fiction to reality, or were the annotations other than that?
No, it was one of these special edition copies with pictures in the middle. It wasn't highlighter marks from, you know, some overzealous reader. Though I certainly hope when people read my book, they, you know, mark it up to the nines and really destroy it so the next person who gets it can see the first person's thoughts. But the annotations were like some alternative endings, I think, some commentary about the places. There were some footnotes. I don't remember exactly what they were. I don't remember if when Hemingway was saying the 10 guys, 10 different stories, if he said that in the narrative itself or somewhere in the annotations.
Do you remember what resonated with you about that book at that time?
Yes. The title of the book, A Movable Feast, I think was a thesis and a descriptor. Paris really was a movable feast for them back in the 20s. World War I had just ended. They called themselves the Lost Generation. They were dislocated in time and space. A lot of them were American. Hemingway was American. Scott Fitzgerald was American. He was from Missouri. Gertrude Stein, I believe, was American. And they sort of set up shop. They weren't the only ones to do this. In Paris, George Plimpton did it in the 1950s and 60s. He later went on to found the Paris Review, who I can't be sure, but I would imagine that some Trinity alums probably were editors there, or if not, you know, went to the parties on 73rd Street or wherever that townhouse was. What resonated with me was that I was 16. I was lost. My mother had died when I was 13 while I was at Trinity. That was in sixth grade. I completed seventh and eighth grade. I went to France, summer of seventh grade, summer of eighth grade for various different summer programs that I had found. I was very fortunate that my father allowed me to do that, enabled me to do that. And then my freshman year of high school, I went to a boarding school in New Jersey. I wanted to sort of get away. Maybe that was my way of coping with my mother's death a little bit. I wanted to go to Paris, so I got accepted to a class at the Sorbonne and then found some other classes, and I went. The next summer, I got accepted to this creative writing workshop that when I showed up and they found out I was 17. They were like, what are you doing here? There was no spot to put your age on the application. So a bunch of like grown-up professional writers from all over the state. And I just showed up, cigarette in hand, probably a bit hungover from the night before, big sunglasses on. And I said, you know, let's get into it. That's in this book, actually, The Paris Years. The first Paris Year is actually in this book, too. But I mean, to answer your question in a roundabout way, what was I thinking about? I was thinking about being a young man sort of dislocated in time and space, an American in Paris. My French wasn't that great back then. I was on my own. I was, you know, on the cusp of my adolescence. I was reading Hemingway. I'd first finding out about Bukowski and Virginia Woolf. I would carry around this like Renaissance painting book that I never read a single page. I just had it as sort of a prop. I thought it made me cultured. I thought maybe one day I'll read this. The music teacher at my boarding school, Mr. Palmer, had gifted it to me, and I told him I'd read it. I never did. I did return it to him and thanked him for having lent me such an interesting book, but I speculated as to whether it was actually that interesting. I think there's something about being a young man in Paris that's is sort of magical, and I'm glad I got to be a part of it. I think I'll go back to Paris this summer, now that I'm talking about this.
Did you intentionally go to Paris hoping to be a young man in Paris like the Lost Generation, or was there some other impetus?
I don't know whether Scott and Zelda and Ernest and Gertrude predated my first Paris adventure. I went freshman summer and sophomore summer. I had read Fitzgerald. I got A Movable Feast, as I mentioned before, while I was there. I think I was drawn to the city. I don't remember exactly from what. Various literary and artistic influences, and I wanted to go far away. So I think, actually, I don't know what the rules are these days. I mean, kids are so soft these days. I mean, there's all these, you know, rules, and some of them are in place for good reason. You know, you don't want kids being kidnapped or whatever. But I don't know if a 16-year-old is allowed to fly alone. But I did. So no one stopped me.
Well, if there was no place on the form to put your age.
Exactly. That was the next summer. Yeah. No, but I mean at the airport. Yeah, I wanted to go and I went.
And so it doesn't sound like you had any particular expectations except to get away.
I wanted to get away. I wanted to be in a, you know, a foreign place around foreign people. I ended up inadvertently living in the red light district as a 16-year-old whose language skills were not prolific. I was living in Pigalle, which is, I won't swear on this podcast, but it's not the nicest part of town. There's lots of professionals moseying around and sex shops, and, you know, the Moulin Rouge is up there. Montmartre is really nice, but it's like cool because it's kind of seedy. All the, you know, great painters, impressionists, whatever, used to hang out there. Now, you know, we're talking 100 years later now. But I moved there. I remember. I was living next to a graveyard. It was great, you know. No one asks you for, you know, an ID. You can drink. You can go wherever you want, more or less. It's funny. There's an anecdote in the book. I was at a bar, a nice bar, cocktail bar. The bartender said, "You're 18, right?" And I said, "No." And he just, you know, the color like drains from the guy's face. And I'm just like eating my peanuts. Relax. I said, and then, you know, pause for dramatic effect. And I say, "I'm 22. And it was such a cheeky little pause. And he must have known that I was not, in fact, 22. But this is like a, you know, it's a nice bar. There's no bouncer. He knew I wasn't 22. And I knew that he knew that I wasn't 22. We were both happy to just smile and lie to each other. And I write about this in the book as an instance of sound waves oftentimes being devoid of meaning. People say things as sort of complicated airflow. That's what a succession character called them. Like when, you know, someone says, "Hey, how you doing?" "Yeah, good, thanks. How about you?" It's such an answer from instinct. It's not genuine. And the person asking the question often doesn't give any particular kind of hoot about it either. See, I stopped myself there, Kevin. Facci non floccio. I learned that from William Wilmot. I don't give a hoot. So when someone says, you know, "Hey, how you doing?" And it's like, "Yeah, good, thanks." The interrogative is fake. It's a sound wave that's kind of devoid of meaning. Or it's not that it's devoid of meaning. It's a pleasantry. It's a kind of greeting. But the words are divorced from their literal meaning, if that makes sense. In different languages, this functions differently. Like in Spanish, you say "todo bien," like is everything good. In English, in England, they say "you all right," like "you're you okay." Whereas in American English, if you say "you okay," that's like "are you sad?" So it's just interesting how language functions, and the words that are coming out of our mouth are often divorced from their literal meaning. So much is contextual. And with this bartender, 1,000 words were spoken between us, but none of which had to do with "are you 18? No, I'm 22. I didn't mean what I said. He knew that I didn't mean what I said, but it was fine.
Tell me about the novella that you wrote. That was it the first summer or the second summer?
It was the first summer. I wrote a novella called "And So the Sun Sets." I just reread it the other day. It's slightly brilliant, if I do say so myself. I'm joking. It's, you know, it's something that would come from a 16-year-old. But I do think, you know, there's something there. I might have it illustrated at some point, find my own Ralph Steadman, and, you know, see if I can publish it. The novella was called "And So the Sun Sets." It was 11,000 words or something like this. I used it to get into this creative writing program in Paris. It was a series of short stories about a young man in New York living with his grandmother because his parents have died. And then he finds pretext to go to Paris. He makes up some excuse to give to his grandmother. He also runs an underground gambling ring and is the champion of an underground fight club. And he makes money through this underground gambling ring and the underground fight club. And he moves to Paris. He sees, it's sort of like the Siddhartha narrative. I haven't actually read Siddhartha, but the Buddha narrative of he goes outside the walls and he sees the ugliness of the world. It's each chapter sort of has a lesson contained therein. There's one chapter where I'm at a bar and this guy keeps yammering on about this woman she's going to come back. She's going to come back, but, you know, she's never coming back. And he's just, you know, this sad sap, sending all his money to this woman she's gone, buddy. There was that chapter. There was another chapter called "The Woman in the Red Dress" about an affair between the narrator and a woman who, as you would imagine, he met while she was wearing a red dress, and how she, you know, had all the things that, like many people's parents who go to this school and many people who graduate from this school, you know, they have all the things that you're supposed to have, you know, a nice job, a nice apartment, a nice girlfriend, all the right society clubs, the right squash racket, all this stuff. But they're deeply unhappy. They're deeply unfulfilled. There's a great ennui among them. And the relationship between the narrator and this woman in the red dress is she's this wealthy Parisian woman who has a nice apartment and she has nice clothes and she has all the life, you know, Elle and Vogue and all the lifestyle magazines, but she's deeply dissatisfied, more so than a normal Parisian would be dissatisfied because they thrive on that. You know, it explores that dichotomy. What is happiness? By whose metrics are you living? If you live by, you know, whatever conventional metrics and you have the magazines, you have the job, you have the dress, you have the address, whatever, but you're still not fulfilled, you think to yourself, who created this stuff? Maybe this doesn't work for me. There's a chapter about that. It's a chapter about a prostitute getting beaten up by a group of sort of sadistic Parisian businessmen. And the narrator witnessing this is fiction. It's all loosely autobiographical. I'll leave which parts are fiction or not to your imagination, but I never witnessed a prostitute being beaten up, though I did certainly see a lot of ugliness. And then he goes and like helps the prostitute and gets her, you know, a hotel room for a few nights and some charcuterie or whatever. So yeah, it's a book about this sort of coming of age, loss of innocence. Eventually, at the end, he has to come back to New York. There's more tragedy in New York, but he's finally, he being the narrator, loosely based on me, he's aware that the world is sort of cruel and indifferent and absurd. And he's very much okay with that. And he finds the company of others who are also okay with that. There's something of a kind of closure in that. There's a short story by Dennis Lehane called Animal Rescue. It was turned into a film called The Drop with Tom Hardy and James Gandolfini. Anyway, Dennis Lehane, you know, I think he wrote Run River as well. He wrote the short story, and one of the last lines of the short story is, sometimes you just can't control things. I think that's an important line for any teenage boy or girl or adolescent to internalize.
And what made you want to pursue that kind of writing?
So that was fiction. And that was my first experiment with writing. Well, it wasn't creative nonfiction. It was fiction, if you will, autofiction or first-person narration. What made me want to? I started writing in Shakespeare and Company one day. I had this green notebook. I still have it in my bedroom with all my notes and plans for the first chapter. And I had been watching Californication with David Duchovny, who I later found out went to Princeton. I didn't even know that. But I'd been watching Californication, and I kind of knew who Bukowski was. And I was like, wait a minute. What if we can leave something behind? What if we can like leave a record behind for other people? And I was always good at the English class. I never excelled in... It's not that I never excelled in math. It didn't come as easily to me. And oh my God, I was something of a terrorist in Dr. Michelle's classroom. I was not the most quiet and diligent student. That was seventh grade, I think. I was good at English. The essays made sense. You know, I did well in the classes. I liked writing. I knew I was good at it. And it always kind of made sense to me. I could write about anything. I could write history. I could write English. I liked that there's no one answer. You can form your own argument. Ann Johnson was a real pain in the derriere as far as grading goes, but she taught us how to write a research paper. I mean, that's for certain. She was a tough cookie. I'm sure she still is. I can't imagine she's budged one inch, and I would hope that she hasn't. Anyway, I don't know, Kevin. I liked writing. I was good at it, and I started doing it professionally, and, you know, apparently you can make money from this kind of thing and, you know, pay your rent. So the fraud police haven't arrived yet.
But it does seem like a conscious choice.
It was absolutely a conscious choice. Again, this goes back to I wrote this novella my freshman summer, and then it became college, college, college. I stopped doing my writing. I stopped focusing on what I loved. And I didn't really write again until junior spring of high school. I was invited to the Breadloaf School of English for at Middlebury for a creative writing conference. And I went there, but I wasn't like actively writing in the same way that I used to. I used to write poetry. I was, you know, writing all the time. And I really just got sucked into the college admissions game. And I mean, people listening probably are familiar with it, but classes are the tip of the iceberg. Extracurriculars, summers, it's a four-year investment. I put it in a shelf and locked it away for a while. And then in college, too, I picked up the whole investment banking, management consulting thing, as many kids who go to Trinity do. And I was fortunate to be able to break away from that. I think it works for some people, and some people I'm sure are great bankers and great consultants, but I think a lot of people just do it because it's the thing to do.
Can we talk about the creative writing class in Paris? I'm curious about it.
Yeah, it wasn't a class. It was a workshop.
Okay.
Run by this guy named Rolf Potts. He's a travel writer. Rolf Potts wrote a book called Vagabonding, off of which I've loosely based my life now. I don't have a fixed address. It's funny, I was in Newfoundland last week at a journalism conference, the Ski Club of International Journalists. Shameless plug for skis. If you're a journalist and you're American or you're from any country, you should join Skij. We're actively recruiting members. Reach out to me, snewman477@gmail.com. Actively in the recruitment period. Each year we ski at a different place around the world. This year it was in Newfoundland. Next year it's in Kazakhstan. The year after it's in Andorra. This year there were 95 journalists from 23 countries. It was awesome. Anyway, back to the creative writing workshop. Rolf Potts was the guy who ran this workshop. Brilliant travel writer, sort of like a Paul Theroux type character. Paul Theroux wrote The Great Railway Bazaar. He ran it. This woman, Dinah Lenny, was teaching there. She's a screenwriter. I think she's at USC or one of the S's. This guy, John Biganay, who's an English teacher at Loyola in New Orleans. And I was 17. I got accepted to this workshop in like May because I was trying to figure out what I would do for that summer. And I submitted samples of the novella that I'd written the year before. And when I got there, Rolf was like, how old are you? It wasn't the first conversation. One time we were talking, I was talking with Rolf, and he goes, when I mentioned my teacher, somehow it came up in conversation that I was going to my junior year of high school and not my junior year of college. And he was like, oh, wouldn't have accepted you if I knew that. You know, this is like, it's for grownups. But we read each other's work, you know, in the workshops, and there was a bar next to the campus that we would have open mics at. I don't think I was of legal drinking age then either, but I drank. I met some wonderful people there. My friend Drew, keep in touch with him. This girl Morgan, this girl Brittany, another girl who became Hannah in the book. This guy Austin was there. He was the next youngest guy. He was in actual college. I think he might have been like 20. His mom was there, this woman Powell, so telling me to quit cigarettes, which I have now, by the way, 6 years after Powell asked me to. It was a really wonderful experience. You know, I was with people who wrote for, some of them wrote for a living. And you learn there's something about being in Paris. It draws sort of great artwork out of you. And then also being in the company of other artists really draws something out of you, you know.
Did you find that being in the company of older, kind of established writers, were you kind of leveling up to them because of their level of expertise and work?
Yeah, I think there was certainly an element of that. When you show up to the tango party, you better dance tango correctly. So there's like a striving to do the work, to be taken seriously, to put your best foot forward. It's sort of the story of my life. I've frequently been the youngest in these environments. And I think I put myself in these environments on purpose so that I can learn. I was the youngest editor ever hired at Quillette, which is an art and science magazine that I ran for the last year with three other people in Sydney, London, and Toronto. I was, when I was hired, 23. My next youngest colleague was 36 at the time, and then 40-something, and then in their 50s. And there was, you know, Scott reporting for duty with slightly less, but, you know, the same sort of mandate, more or less equal responsibility. At Skij, Newfoundland last week, I was 24. I was really the youngest. It was a bunch of people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. But it was wonderful. You know, I was everyone's darling. I left with a Slovenian hat, an Italian sweater, a Serbian shirt. It was a really special experience. And these were all journalists at Skij. Plug again, from 23 countries and across print, radio, and TV, and digital podcast, you know, all kinds of multimedia stuff. So people worked across mediums, across countries, and some of them were really quite impressive. And then, you know, Deborah Scott and Quillette running the magazine. Most of the people who wrote for us at Quillette had PhDs. So I would like hide behind the screen, you know, thinking, you know, some seasoned pro is editing their paper. No. Fresh out of college, Scott is editing the PhD's essay. But I made friends with a lot of these people. Actually, one of my friend, Tony, just emailed me today I published some of his first work for Quillette. I think it was about Dostoevsky. He's a fantastic writer, great guy. Tony's at the Santa Fe Institute and just a really sharp individual. But, you know, how did I do that when I was 23? It's not that I'm smarter than lots of people. I leveled up. I think it's a great way to learn. There's this guy, Sahil Bloom. I just interviewed him on my podcast. The episode is forthcoming. And one of his things is like, if you choose between two rooms, one where you're the smartest person in the room, one where you're the dumbest person in the room, go to the one where you're the dumbest so you can like learn and level up. I think that's true. But a lot of people, you know, they'd rather, you know, they want to stroke their ego and they don't want to be challenged and they don't want to look foolish or look silly. So they go and they be the smartest and they don't f-ing learn anything.
What made you take up writing again junior year of college?
Junior year of college, what made me take up writing? Oh, there was this horrible little pandemic going on. And I was in Australia at the time. Actually, I had started writing the book before. I was working an internship at this venture capital firm, and it was really boring. And this guy emailed me, and he was like, you want to write a book? And I was like, sounds better than whatever the fuck I'm doing. So I kept the job at the venture capital firm, collected my paycheck and, you know, did the work. But then, you know, at night and sometimes during the day, started working on this book. There was this whole program to help undergrads write books and teach them how to get a book published. So I was like, yeah, whatever. So I started doing this program and a friend's sister had done it. And I started writing it, you know, working on it here and there. And then I hated Princeton. I was really unhappy there. So I wanted to go as far away as possible, just like Paris. And so I went to Australia. And then with the coming of the spicy flu, I could have left Australia if I wanted, but I didn't for a number of reasons. And I was living up in the boonies. They call it the sticks in Australia, but this was like 6.5 hours outside of Sydney and, you know, way up the coast in a place called Coffs Harbour. It's known for the big banana. There's a shop with like an enormous 50-foot banana. You know, there's some beaches there. It's a surf town. I was living with two Austrians, a German and an American that I had rounded up. I know it sounds like the beginning of a joke, but that's who I was living with. And we lived in this house on the beach that was cheaper than our dorm rooms in Sydney. And I was like, oh yeah, this book thing. I gotta get to work on this, you know, gotta finish it up. So I finished up the book in April, May, June, where we were locked down in that beach house. And I didn't think anyone would read. Well, at first I was writing it as fiction. And then my editor was like, where are you getting all these crazy stories? And I was like, well, most of this happened. He convinced me to write it as nonfiction. I said, all right, let's go. Write it as nonfiction. Wrote it. Didn't think anyone would read it. But you know something, for reasons that continue to elude me, Kevin, they did. A lot of people did read it. Whole little scandal around it. I don't want a bunch of awards. I'm going to Louisiana this weekend, actually, for some book awards that some clerical error produced. Maybe there was some other Scott Newman or Scott Humphrey or something like that. But anyway, by some clerical error, this book won some awards. So maybe more than one or two people did read the book. But there's only one person who it really matters to me if they read the book, and that's Kevin Ramsey. I go to bed at night thinking to myself, I can die happy knowing that Kevin has read this.
So the book that you started in Australia was this book or became this book?
I had started writing, I mean, when does one start a book? It's a memoir covering 14 to 21, covering a lot of the things we just discussed, Paris and the rest. But I started writing, I think, like August 2019 while I was bored at the venture capital firm.
When the editor proposed changing it from fiction to nonfiction, did that sound like a good idea at the time? Were you resistant to it?
Yeah, you know, when you're writing nonfiction, particularly creative nonfiction, like a personal essay, Kevin, you're basically standing there naked in front of the audience, letting them, you know, see every wrinkle and crevice. It's very much the act of undressing and giving people access to what's on the inside. There's certainly an element of voyeurism in it. I think that's why music, where people talk about like their mental health issues, really resonates with others. When you show a certain degree of vulnerability, you write about the things that you messed up, you write about heartbreak, you write about things where you were complicit in doing something in a way that you wouldn't do it again. There's something deeply appealing about that to people because you're sort of peeling back the curtain in a very authentic way. You think about Instagram or makeup or, you know, whatever. We live in a very artificial world where you can kind of present however you would like to present. Whereas I think that creates a sort of market for authenticity. Authenticity sells well. And so I was reticent about standing there naked, writing about my somewhat scandalous relationships with older women, writing about, you know, doing illegal things, whether that's underage drinking or living in Paris alone. I don't know if that's allowed or not. I mean, who's to say what's allowed? I was fine. And my father is a very good parent. When you write about your own life and your own experiences, then everyone else can comment on them. And they did when it came out. There was mixed reviews. There was some negative publicity around this, and it hurt people. They think they know you. Well, in my case, a lot of the people who had grievances hadn't even read the book. They read a New York Post article about the book, which I didn't write. I did mouth off to the reporter. But yeah, I know you're smiling. I mean, you learn your lesson. I think there's a degree of being uncomfortable standing there naked in front of the audience. There's a degree of who wants to read a memoir by a 21-year-old. That was my attitude at first. I mean, I had the main character, me, getting kidnapped in the Jordanian desert, getting deported from England, having his boss get shot, all these wild things. And my editor, this guy Michael, he said, this is not believable. This wouldn't happen to somebody. I can't suspend my disbelief. Willing suspension of disbelief. Learned that in the sixth grade with, I think, Jordy Slutsky. I couldn't suspend my disbelief, is what he said. Like, this is not something that would happen. People aren't going to believe this. And I said, well, they better, because, I mean, this happened. I mean, he said, if it happened, then how do you confer legitimacy? You take ownership of it. So you have to take ownership for the good, the bad, and the ugly. Obviously, it's a book. Some things I took out. Didn't make the final cut for various reasons, but that's what nonfiction is taking ownership of the things you've done, and your legitimacy is conferred from the fact that you did that thing. How are you going to write about being a doctor if you've never been a doctor? Research, interviews, but it only goes so far. This guy, Bill Bulford, he was the editor of Esquire back in before you were born, and he went and he lived with soccer hooligans. And then he wrote a book called Among the Thugs. In order to write about the thugs, he became a thug. This is this whole thing of gonzo journalism. But it confers a degree of legitimacy because you know what you're talking about. So I think that's sort of the appeal of creative nonfiction. But it was tough to decide, you know, I'm going to just write about all my affairs. I mean, literal affairs of the things that happened and my romantic affairs, all of this. Like, that's some personal shit, man. But, you know, there's an appetite for it.
Did you write it because there was an appetite for it? Or did you
No. Okay. I wanted to hold this book in my hand and know that I did this thing. I wrote a book. Now I'm writing another. I found out there was an appetite for it after it came out. I didn't have high hopes.
After it was published and the criticism came out, How did you manage that? How did you manage the choice to be naked in front of readers?
How did I deal with the criticism?
Yeah.
I think it's hard. You publish your first big commercial piece. And a lot of the criticism, some of it was really legitimate. I mean, there's legitimate criticism that I didn't sufficiently acknowledge my own complicity in what I was describing at Princeton. I mean, by the counter argument, you could say I couldn't have written about it if I didn't go to Princeton. But there was a line of thought that I was criticizing a system from which I had benefited. Yes, of course I had benefited from it. But it goes back to legitimacy. When you criticize from the outside, it's only so legitimate. Some kid who doesn't get into Harvard and he writes about what a bad place Harvard is, he just sounds kind of salty. But if you have a kid who did go to Harvard and then he talks about some of the real institutional issues with Harvard, that's more legitimate because he lived it. So how did I deal with the criticism? Most of the criticism, to be honest, came after the New York Post wrote an article about the book. And a lot of the kids at Princeton who piled on to me on Facebook, and I posted the book myself in various Princeton groups, including the Princeton meme group on Facebook because it had so many active members. You know, there was all this wokery nonsense of, a straight white cisgendered male shouldn't be criticizing Princeton. That's ridiculous. We're not going to discount people's opinions because of immutable characteristics. Well, I mean, we shouldn't, but it happens all the time. Hopefully not at Trinity. there was an element of that. There was, you know, it devolved. We're talking about hundreds of comments, if not thousands. I didn't read all of them. I saw some of them. But as to how I dealt with it, it's hard. You labor over something for a year and then people sort of shit on something that they haven't read or grappled with. And all of a sudden, all these kids are literary critics. Like, you've never written a book review of anything in your entire life. You know, you don't even read books, you know. And now, all of a sudden, this is of great interest to you. That was the woke contingent being upset about. I criticized that Princeton was too far to the left and that they didn't have diversity of opinion in their faculty, which is, this is accurate, I think. If they claim they're the number one school in the country, and I was in the history department one day, someone said, the furthest left you're going to get here is Democrat. That's absurd. It's really absurd. How are you going to debate ideas in the marketplace of ideas? How are the better ideas going to win out, even if they are ideas from the left? How are those ideas going to win if there's nobody to contest them? It's just silly and antithetical to the purpose of academia in general. Academia is about testing hypotheses, stress testing hypotheses, and seeing how they perform under pressure, seeing how they perform when confronted with different circumstances. Some of the criticism was legitimate, some of it was not. And either way, it was hard for me to have all these people turning against me. I did receive a lot of support as well, but a lot of the support I received was private and a lot of the criticism I received was public. So it was what it was. And then, you know, you fast forward a year, win its first batch of awards from the Firebird Book Awards, and then a year later in 2022, the Pencraft Book Awards. So how do you like me now? But look, it's not about accolades. If you put out artwork in the world, it should be criticized. Of course it should be criticized. It's the same issue I've just described. It's another flavor of the same milkshake. If you put out artwork and everyone just agrees with it and, you know, nods their head, oh, yes, this is really good. That's not helpful. That's not constructive. Though I did receive some constructive criticism about different aspects of the book. So if you put something out, you know, you better damn well be prepared for people to criticize it. I hope that answers the question, Kevin.
It does.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the next book?
Sure. I'm currently working on a book about the Australia years. I went to Australia my junior spring of study abroad in college. I was supposed to stay for 3 months. I ended up staying closer to 3 years. It was an extraordinary time of my life. I had friends from all over the world. I was living at hostels for $10 a night, traveling all over the country for some of the Australia years. I also worked a full-time job in an office as editor at Quillette later on. But COVID hit Australia in like March of 2020. So Australia was locked down like April, May, June. And then from July of 2020 to June of 2021, it was kind of normal. I mean, you had like some stupid wear a mask on the bus things, but like it was kind of normal. It was better than the US. Depends where you were in the US, better than New York. But the border was closed, the external border. And so it created this closed loop on the hostel circuit in Byron, Cairns, Darwin, wherever. And so all the backpackers would sort of run into each other again. And so whenever I would say goodbye to someone, I said, well, you know, I'll see you somewhere sometime. And I often did. I ran into my friends from Byron and in Airlie Beach, and I ran into my friends from Darwin and Sydney, and it was sort of a closed loop. We had all just been locked down. We were all foreigners. We were all, you know, in a strange new world. It just didn't seem real. It seemed very much like a kind of dreamscape of some kind. And so it didn't really seem to exist. Like, I'm not even sure that it did exist. Like, was it all... was any of it real? So I say somewhere, sometime, the Australia years as I knew them, because it's a double entendre, the saying goodbye, and then because where was I? When was this? What was this strange time? Well, the world was shut down and we were traveling in vans around different hostels. I would strongly recommend any Trinity alum to go and live in Australia for a year, perhaps to the chagrin of your parents. It's a wonderful place. Look into working holiday visas. Stay for 2 years or three. Kevin can get behind this.
Preferably not during a pandemic, though.
No, maybe don't time it during a pandemic. But I was there, and I stayed, and, you know, it was fine.
Scott Newman, thank you very much again for coming in. It was great to talk to you. The book, again, is The Night Before, The Morning After, And thank you. I look forward to talking to you again when the next book comes out.
I look forward to that as well. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
This podcast was brought to you by Trinity School in New York City. For more information about Trinity School, please visit our website at www.trinityschoolnyc.org. This has been a production of Trinity School Pod Misum.